Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
I've been reading a book that's had quite a lot of attention this year. It came out at the beginning of 2023. It's one of the big sort of debuts of the year. The New Life by Tom Cruise, published by Chatto. And I really, really loved it. It's one of those books. I mean, it hasn't been listed for, I think possibly surprisingly, hasn't been listed for the book, or it wasn't listed for the Waterstones Debut Prize. And I, for both of those prizes, I was sort of vaguely surprised that it wasn't on there, if you know what I mean. It is written by Tom Crew, who is a writer. Writes for Literary Review, and he has a PhD in Victorian history or Victorian literature. And this novel is set in London in 1894. And this is sort of my very favourite, like, period of history. Late Victorian, fin de siècle, Victorian London is just, I love it. I'm obsessed with it. I did my degree in Victorian studies, and that's what I did my dissertation on, was that sort of period. So this is sort of right in my sweet spot. And even more than that, it is about sort of radical politics and being gay, and it, like, that sort of the kind of subversive side of late 19th century sort of culture and politics, which is also what I did my dissertation on, and I'm just really interested in. So it follows these two men, so John and Henry. John is married to Catherine, has been for many years. They have grown up children. Henry is a bit younger, and he has just married. Well, we see the wedding at the beginning of the novel. He's married to Edith. John and Catherine's marriage on the front looks very normal. Quote unquote, it's very traditional, very staid. But the secret is that John is homosexual, and sort of over a number of years, Catherine has obviously realised his proclivities. And there's a sort of tacit understanding between them that, you know, he can go and do as he pleases as long as no shame, no controversy is brought upon the household, that the children never find out, that as far as, you know, he keeps it discreet, and he keeps it away from Catherine, and he keeps everything hush hush. And certainly up to the point in the beginning of the novel, that is how he has lived. Henry, on the other hand, and Edith, his new wife, are sort of very politically engaged, very idealistic, radical. You know, they go to all the meetings, they write essays, you know, they write for journals, they give lectures on women's rights and socialist politics and everything else. And they have sort of entered into this intellectual marriage. It's very much a kind of, this is a, they've got a marriage of principle. Obviously, it helps them in society to be married, but they are eyes open. This is not a traditional marriage. It's not a consummated marriage. They continue to live separately. But they want to show what marriage could be, you know, that marriage doesn't have to be what you know, what it has been up to that point. That intellectually they're very compatible, but they don't, you know, they're not in love. And Edith shortly thereafter falls in love and starts having a relationship with a woman called Angelica. And Henry's quite conflicted because he's kind of getting feelings for Edith. He's, you know, he's not held up to the bargain. But he's very true to his principles, and he wants to further the new life, as they call it. And one way or another, John and Henry end up in correspondence, and they decide to write a book together. Basically, it's a kind of call for homosexual rights, for saying that it was a normal and natural thing, a normal part of life. People should be allowed to be, to love who they want to love, etc. Except right in the middle of all of this, which is controversial anyway, the Oscar Wilde trial happens. He gets sent down. Controversy, controversy, controversy. And so the novel becomes both a portrait of both of these marriages. John also starts a relationship with a guy who he basically starts bringing into the house, and does not hold up his end of the bargain on keeping things at a respectful distance. So this marriage is collapsing, this marriage is collapsing, even though it's not a traditional marriage. Everyone's in love with different people, but also at the heart of this is this sort of intellectual enterprise of writing this book, and should it go ahead, and someone getting cold feet because the whole Oscar Wilde stuff. It's very, very, very well written. It's very well done. There's loads of kind of character and development in there, as well as all the kind of political stuff. It's just won the Orwell Prize for Political Fiction, and it absolutely deservedly. If you like Victorian novels, which I do and you less do, then you know it reads like a Victorian novel. I mean, slightly up to date, but it absolutely reads like a Victorian novel. And it's quite brilliant. Quite an eye-opening opening scene on the tube, where a man is manually relieved, shall we say. So, you know, it's confronting in the first pages, but it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, deserves all the plaudits it's got, and a really gorgeous object as well. Like, you know, hardbacks are expensive, there's a cost of living crisis, and I guess, you know, if you've got a debut writer and you want people to shell out for a paper, for a hardback in this economy, making it a very beautiful object is one way to you know, encourage people to take the punt. And it's a really gorgeous book as well.
Yeah, I had noticed it because it's got this beautiful sort of orange cover with a black and white photo on, and everyone I know has read it has raved about it. So I'm sort of like, I'm intrigued by it, by what you've said about it. It sounds like a really interesting premise, but as you pointed out, I am not a big fan of Victorian novels. So
it feels like your politics, but not your writing style.
Yeah, possibly. And like, there's stuff I read, like The Crimson Petal and the White, I loved, and Sarah Waters stuff, like, yeah. I love. So there is some like pseudo Victorian stuff that I enjoy, and others that I just think's laborious. So. But no, it does sound interesting. I was thinking when you said about it being your favourite historical period, I was like, have I got a favourite historical period? And I went, oh, the 1980s, which I actually lived through, is my favourite historical period. But there we are.
So, yeah, I'm just horrified that the 80s is historical, but it is.
Yeah, it is, afraid so. Yes. It sounds like one that, I don't know, it sounds intriguing. It sounds like something that I might get from the library if I fancied having a go at it.
Yeah, like I would, yeah, get it at the library, see how you feel about it. I think it's a very good way to do it. But it's, you know, it just packs so much in without it feeling so overloaded. You know, it's not like it's an average length. It's not like a 800-page doorstop. It's a sort of normal 300-odd page.
It's not fucking Middlemarch.
It's not Middlemarch. It's not Vanity Fair or Bleak House. It is absolutely brilliant. So, yes, I commend it to you. What have you been reading?
I have been reading something completely different. I've been reading Queen Care by Sarah Thomas. And now, when I mentioned it to you, and I mentioned it to someone else earlier in the week, this seems to have passed people by. So, like, the opposite of Tom Cruise book. You can't say it without it sounding like Tom Cruise.
Apostrophe, yes. Apostrophe, yes.
Yeah, this seems to be a little bit under the radar. So this came out from Serpent's Tail. Sorry, I should say what it is, isn't it? It's called Queen Kate. It's by Sarah Thomas. It's a thriller. It's a literary thriller. Serpent's Tail published it in hardback earlier in the year, but I am pretty sure, so it's beginning of September. It's just come out in paperback, I think. I'm confused by that because I have a large format paperback proof, so I don't know what's going on, frankly. And it's been sitting on my shelf for a little while, because I think I got sent it before Christmas. Anyway, I was keen to read it, and it's interesting. So normally, well, you'll see later on when we get onto two books to talk about this week, I have a massive problem with posh people and money and not really caring. So this book is literally set in the world of an oligarch and his family. And the person narrating is their daughter's tutor. So it starts off in Courchevel, and then it moves to Monaco, and then it ends up in the Maldives. So, and it's three different periods in their life. So Mel, who's the narrator, she went to a British private school. She is employed, and the woman who wrote it, this was her job. So she has been a tutor to the like wealthiest people in the world, their kids anyway. So it's well, that sort of idea is based on her experience. I'm not sure the characters are, but she so she's employed to go and help this daughter get into a British boarding school, basically. And she turns up and the daughter's not very happy to see her. And it turns out the daughter's super bright anyway. And she doesn't actually need a tutor, that the mother's employed her because that's what people who are rich do. And what starts to unravel, because the husband's an oligarch, is that basically because they are new money, despite the fact they are absolutely fucking loaded, they like there's that whole thing in there, particularly in Britain, like the class system, that you cannot access those. I mean, I've talked about it, being a working class person around middle class people, and I'm sure you find it in publishing industry as well, that there are things that middle class people do and understand as part of their social etiquette that is just absolutely fucking foreign to me. Not a Scoobies.
I find other than alarming people I know in real life have been skiing.
Yes,
I've never been skiing. Who goes? I don't understand, especially in a country that does not have a lot of snow, unless you live up in the north of Scotland or whatever, how you end up going skiing. Like, it just, it boggles my mind. Skiing as a concept blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I would just fall over and break something. Oh, which also, yeah, so I don't understand going skiing anyway. So yeah, she gets into this British boarding school. It turns out she doesn't actually want to go. Her mum wants her to go, because what her mum wants is, she's felt like she never belongs. So does the husband, but the husband's a lot more cautious of what people want from him. So they grew up like in middle of nowhere with no money. And it does talk about, if you don't know about how the oligarchs made their money, there is a little bit of mention of the fact that they basically bought up all the resources from the state in their country and made lots of money off the back of it. Yeah, and he's sort of in and out a lot. So she manages to sort of scheme when he's not there about the ways that she's going to get accepted into society, because that's all she wants, is to be accepted as part of the glitterati and whatever. Yeah. So then the second bit is when Alex, the daughter, is she's got a GCSEs coming up. So they employ Mel again. And then the third bit, when she's got her A-levels coming up, you know from the beginning that Kata, the mother, dies. So it's more of a like, why done it than a who done it? Although you don't actually find out, this is a bit of a spoiler, but you don't, it's not all tied up in a neat bow. You don't actually, like, you have to sort of put some bits together and work out what could have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting. It's all to do with the fact that she's trying to be accepted. And sort of instrumental in it as well is one of the girls that Alex meets at school. So when she first gets there, like, they take the piss out of her, basically, because she's Russian and they're horrible to her. And then this girl called Tatiana makes sort of a beeline for her, and she is on a reality TV show. So obviously then her mum, so it's Kata that invites her to spend time with Alex. Alex ain't bothered. And it changes the way that the other girls talk to her, of course, because she's got a friend who's on a TV show, blah, blah, blah. And so she's sort of instrumental in the whole unraveling. And then there's another oligarch involved, and there's a British aristocrat, because of course there is. And yeah, so it's sort of interesting watching that, because I just think it's all bullshit in it, but it's interesting sort of watching the way that they're behaving and the way she's trying to, like, she thinks that people behave who've got that sort of wealth and amenities. I think the best thing about it for me was that the characters are really well drawn. So it's really interesting, particularly Mel, actually, the narrator, and the way she sort of observes what's going on and what people want and how they behave because of they want. And she's also got a backstory with her mum's an alcoholic. So she has a sort of a ropey relationship with her mum because of that. And there's a point when she comes out to visit. So you sort of see how she's behaving and stuff. So it's interesting to see why Mel's doing what she does and the way she behaves. So yeah, character-wise, it's really interesting. It's been compared to Highsmith, which I sort of go at because everything's compared to, you know what I mean? And Patricia Highsmith is a one-off as far as I'm concerned. So it's not as good as Ripley, of course it's not. But I found it intriguing, and like I kept you know what I mean? I've kept picking it up when I'd got time to sit and read, and like I wanted to get back to it. So yeah.
I am so sick of books being compared to The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
It almost now actively puts me off. Oh, he's
Yeah.
the Highsmith. Yes, no. But that's a comparison aside, it does sound really interesting. And I think the thing that sounds most interesting to me is that sort of wanting to fit in and perform what society expects of someone in that position. Which I get, well, it's like a form of imposter syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah, and I also think like the other side, what happens when you don't fit in? And yeah, I think all that sort of stuff's interesting. It's that like societal structure stuff, isn't it? That I just think it's all bullshit, but kind of fascinating how people like either want, yeah, it's a bit like it's like school, isn't it? I mean that I suppose that's partly what I found interesting about it, because there's sort of that it's not straightforwardly drawn, but there's that parallel between Alex at school and Kata trying to be part of society, and how like it's brutal at school, isn't it? Or it was for me, that because you're different, or and that thing, yeah, there's so much conformity at school for in various ways that just makes people's lives a misery basically. I to be honest, I'm like, I'm sure the people who were like the most conformist were probably miserable as fuck as well. Anyway, I'm popular with it because they were just hiding whatever quirky things they were interested in. You
Yeah,
can't.
absolutely. I was a overweight goth with a weird accent. It was reasonably clever. It's like none of those things are conducive to popularity at secondary school. So yeah, I absolutely get that sort of outsider thing. I do sort of occasionally wonder what the popular girls are doing now. I haven't stayed in touch with anyone really from school, a couple of people, but I do wonder what the sometimes what the popular girls are doing these days.
I just assume that they're all married with several kids and in some job that they hate with a big mortgage.
Yeah, and doing like a Facebook MLM on the side. Buy my aloe vera.
Yeah.
That sort of
Oh,
thing.
bit of what's it called? The beauty thing that used to go door to door.
Avon.
Yes.
I like Avon. Avon is all right, but you know those kind of like they're all trying to set. It's basically a massive pyramid scheme. People trying to sell leggings or
Yeah.
beauty products with candles or bath melts. I recently went back on Facebook after some time off it because not really because I wanted to, but because there's a huge number of like school related, like my kids' school related stuff where it's all done through Facebook groups, and it's just like, oh, I like
Yeah.
gonna have to be on it. And
So
I
they're
do.
going to make some more money off me, yeah.
It's yeah, it's it feels like a sociological experiment sometimes that I'm living in.
Also hate school groups, but I'm past those days, thankfully.
Oh, I'm not. It's yeah, no, they're quite something. Right, so following on from the fact that you can't bear posh people and don't particularly enjoy reading about them, the two books we're talking about this week are two group biographies of quite a lot of fairly posh people
With lots of money,
with lots of money.
the
The two books we're talking about are Square Haunting, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars by Francesca Wade, and No Modernism Without Lesbians by Diana Sahami. Both books came out in 2020. Both books deal with sort of early 20th century notable women in various fields. Square Haunting takes a square in Bloomsbury called Mecklenburg Square as it's sort of that's the kind of hook. There's the hook it's all been hung on is that these five women have at various points and sometimes for quite short periods have lived and worked in Mecklenburg Square in Bloomsbury. And then the other book takes these four women who were all lesbians who were sort of influential in the kind of modernist period, one way or the other. We haven't. Which one do you want to start with?
I don't mind.
Should we start with? Let's start with No Modernism Without Lesbians then. So that is published by Hedda Zeus, as I said, in 2020. Lots of amazing reviews. It won Polari Book Awards. It takes a look at four women, Sylvia Beach, Natalie Barney, Briar, and Gertrude Stein, who were, so Sylvia Beach was a publisher, involved in Shakespeare and Company bookshop in Paris as well, and published Ulysses by James Joyce when no one else would touch it. Natalie Barney, who was a fantastically wealthy woman who became a sort of patron of artists and writers. Briar, who was a kind of society hostess and was in a relationship with HD. That's right, isn't it? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And HD is someone who's into werehaunting, so a bit of crossover there. And then Gertrude Stein, who, if you have heard from anyone in this book, is probably going to be the one that you might have heard of. Writer, was in with, you know, mates with Picasso and all that lot in Paris. And her sort of most famous book is The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which I have tried and failed to read three times. I'll get on to that. So it's a group biography, so really it's sort of these four kind of potted biographies of these women, but the sort of the hook for this one is that they were all lesbians, and there we go. That's sort of where we start from. What now? So I liked both books. I hasten to add, I preferred Square Haunting. You preferred No Modernism Without Lesbians. What was it about this book that you liked?
The lesbians, obviously. No.
Correct answer. Moving on.
I thought it was loads of fun. I thought it was like, and it's written in a like, oh, I hate saying readable. But you know what I mean? And if you say easy read, it's like, oh, it's so fraught, all these terms. But it is quite a like fun thing to read. Like, so each of the chapters is like 100 pages, but I felt like I was sort of racing through it because they're split up into like sort of short bits as well. So I guess that helps. But yeah, one, loads of fun. Two, lots about like people's dress and how they were dressing. And so Sylvia Beach, like right from the beginning, and I mean, this comes up sometimes in Square Haunting as well, but not quite as much. But like Sylvia Beach talks about, she ends up during the First World War working as a farmhand. And she says she wore a khaki blousen, is that how you say it? Blousen? Don't know.
Blouson.
And plus fours, and delighted in the sense of liberation these managed clothes brought her and the curiosity they provoked. My khaki suit is gaped at something awful, she wrote in August to Cyprian. She had her hair cut short, felt liberated at not having to ride side saddle in a skirt, liked the 12-hour days of hard physical work, and though she missed the urban culture, enjoyed defying assumptions of how women should dress. And I think, I mean, she dresses sort of mannishly, but then Natalie Barnier, with her salon that she creates, so she creates this Academie des Femmes as a sort of, what's the word? As a like counterpoint to the male academy Francois, is it, that's all male, but they all like at the salons there's photos of them and they all look like they're dressed like Florence from Florence and the Machine. Or possibly I should say that Florence dresses like they did, but it's all very sort of floaty dresses, Grecian, Greece being the sort of pinnacle of modern intellectual thought and whatever. And I don't know, I thought this book was a lot of fun, actually. I thought it was fun. I think that's why I liked it. And despite the whole, you know, oh my god, rich people, and I think what annoys me about that, so what irritated me about it, and like this is me, this is not particularly the book, is stuff being written, so much stuff being sort of written and concentrated on these women who did do things that were massive. So like you said, Sylvia Beach published Ulysses when nobody would touch it, and James Joyce screwed her over it as well. Briar started the first ever film magazine Close Up. You know, they were doing really interesting things, these women, but they've got the means to do it. So this whole thing about them being lesbians in Paris and going against the tide and all the rest of it, yes, but their money protected them to a great extent. And I was like, what about all the like lesbians that are living in, I don't know, Barnsley, married to men they don't want to marry, you know what I mean? Or who were the working class women who were also subverting things who we don't know about? And I think that's what it is. It's got that in my head that, like, where are all these stories that are missing about the people who were doing this, who weren't like wealthy and living it up in Paris, basically?
Yeah, I think that was my slight reservation about it in a way, because I mean, I love a lesbian as much as the next person, as you know, but I did sort of end up finding it an almost arbitrary way of grouping these women. It almost felt like there was like a narrative being forced on it in that sense. So, you know, yes, as you say, these women did do incredible important things because of their money, but it's almost that idea of, you know, it talks about, you know, modernism in art and writing sort of upended what the 19th century had done to society. You know, all these, you know, Victorian rules were being overturned. So why shouldn't, you know, sexual conduct be, you know, this is sort of going back to what we're talking about with the new life. And I don't feel necessarily that comfortable with the idea of subversive sexuality for the sake of upending rules. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're queer, you're queer. That's like, that's just, and you should be able to just live your life authentically, without it being a kind of, I am going to be a lesbian because it's, you know, that idea of political lesbianism or political gayness or political queerness or however you want to, like, it's never quite sat right with me. Just be who you be, gender, sexuality, you know, however you want to identify, but do it because it's truly who you are, not like what you want to overturn or what don't it. Not what it's what you don't want to be. Do you know what I mean? You don't want to be straight, traditional, normal, that's a terrible word, but, you know, kind of in society's eyes, quote unquote, normal. And that, so to group these particular people together, you know, I mean, the title of the book is meant to be provocative, right? No modernism without lesbians. Mm-hmm. I.e., there could be no modernism without lesbians, and that might well be true. But I don't think it's inherently their lesbianism that made them radical. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was radical at that time, but not. Oh God, I'm getting myself in knots. But you know what I mean? No. Like, it's not a kind of.
Yeah, so they were. So Sylvia Beach was radical because she opened a bloody bookshop and published James Joyce when nobody else would touch it. And
yeah, exactly.
Briar's radical, well, because she had fucking loads of money, but she was in a relationship with HD, who had a daughter to some guy whose name I can't remember because who cares. But she was the one who stepped in and looked after Perdita, in that she paid for her to go to school. She made sure she was, like, looked after. She turned up to do some of the caring for her when HD couldn't cope. And, yeah, so there's other ways in which they're... I mean, Gertrude Stein partly is radical because she had such a long relationship with Alice B. Toklas, and that was all in the sense that she was, like... If you were going to compare it to a heterosexual relationship, Alice B. Toklas was her wife and was quite happy to be the woman do it, sorting all the shit out, while Gertrude Stein went round declaring her genius and that starting beefs with James Joyce, which she sounds like a fucking nightmare. But I did enjoy it. I know I'm slightly off the point here, but I very much enjoyed this bit. Because, like, she was just like, she fell out with Beach, didn't she? Because she published Ulysses, and so she withdrew, like, her because it at the original Sylvia and Co, Sylvia Beach basically set it up almost like a library because there were so many people who couldn't afford books, And so, yeah, Gertrude Stein withdrew her membership because of it. But there's a brilliant bit where she says she viewed Joyce as her rival and said he smelled of museums. And that was why he and not she was accepted.
It is a great line.
I just thought that was fantastic.
It is a great line.
I mean, now you could probably say he smelled of museums because he's quite like, he has become more establishment than, you know, she's ever going to be. But that is an hilarious line. By all accounts, he was a tosser, but anyway.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, I have to on that note as well. Sorry, I've derailed this conversation.
But
I have to point out, because this, like, I'm such a child, this made me laugh so much. So there's a point where Gertrude Stein's involved in this love triangle. This is before she meets Alice, with a woman who's called Mary Buxtever, which I was just like, what a name. And then Mary Buxtever or Buxtever gets married and becomes Mrs. Charles Knobloch. And I was like, that is fucking fantastic. Yeah. Not the point entirely, but I enjoyed that little detail. Sometimes the best bits are in the tiny little details.
I think those were my favourite bits of both books, were those sort of kind of everyday small detail. Yeah. And those individual little lines. And
also Briar's brother fucking studying rodents. What the hell?
I know. Like, exactly. And that sort of isn't the point of the book, but they are the bits that I've ended up sort of remembering more than, you know, some of the bigger stuff.
Well, it's like that thing when I was first teaching, I went on this course, and one of the things, this brilliant course, and one of the things the guy was running the course said that there are certain things that you need to do if you want kids to be able to remember stuff. And one of the things is that you do something so, like, outrageous, not in a, like, horrendous way, but, like, say you are, I don't know, you're teaching something and you could dress up as a doctor to do it, then you come into the classroom dressed as a doctor, that, like, they'll never forget it. That's it, and your brain latches onto it because it's unusual, it's out of place, or whatever.
There's a bit with Briar, who, like, as well as sort of paying for all sorts of ridiculous things, like, she paid for Freud to psychoanalyze HD, which is just mad. But, like, also kind of these sort of random acts, like there's a woman who she finds sort of like eating bread, who's got no teeth, and she buys new dentures for her. And there's like another guy who she ends up buying a pair of boots for this other guy that she finds in the street, kind of thing. It's those sorts of, I couldn't decide if that was like, you know, that way that sometimes those kind of random acts of kindness and all that, the end, they're more about the person, they're more for the person doing it than the person receiving the act of generosity, kind of thing. And I could never quite place whether she was doing it sort of for her own benefit or as a kind of, whether it was genuine, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I found her story interesting because she's completely put out that obviously because of the rule of primogeniture that her brother's going to inherit everything, although he doesn't inherit everything. She, and I'm just going to look this up because, like, it is, we are talking ridiculous sums. Her dad was like one of the wealthiest people in the country, if not the wealthiest person in the country, possibly minus the monarchy or whatever.
Yeah.
So Briar's father had died at the height of the Depression. His estate valued for probate at £36,685,000, which there is a note, the equivalent of £2.5 billion in 2020, represented 30% of the nation's wealth passed by probate that year, a fortune accrued by a man who showed little interest in what money could buy. And then it tells you that by the terms of her father's will, Briar received £600,000 outright and a further £600,000 in trust. Note, the equivalent of 30 million in 2020, and she was put out because she wasn't inheriting them. And I get it, like, it's that thing, you know, what it made me think of the whole actors pay, you know, when the female lead isn't paid the same as the male lead, and I totally get kicking off about not being paid equally, but also we are talking extortionate amounts of money. And it felt very much like this, and I was just like, what the fuck. And yeah, So it is a bit of an odd one because I'm just like, that amount of money, 2.5 billion, I mean, like, you could probably end poverty in the UK for less than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just sort of an just ridiculous amount of money. Another thing that just because I found the bit that you were reading, just a bit on the next page, which I'd forgotten about, which is not entirely linked, was a letter that Freud wrote to Breyer from Vienna 2 days after her father's death, which ends, "Far and Tatun are fine and asked to be remembered to you." And Far and Tatun were Freud's puppies. It's like psychoanalyze that.
Yes.
Indeed. Yeah, I did. I thought the book was tremendous fun, and I did enjoy it. I did prefer Square Haunting. I think I prefer the writing, but also I think it's that whole the premise of this particular grouping just felt a little bit forced for me. But also, there's a bit right at the beginning in the introduction, which I couldn't quite get my head around in terms of. So she talk. I'll just find it and I'll read it. Hang on and go. "I duck the initialism of the present age, the LGBTQIA, the quilt bag, queer or questioning, undecided, intersex, lesbian, trans, bisexual, asexual, allied, gay or gender queer, plus the plus. Added recently a P and K, P for pansexual polygamous and K for kink. And now there is the prescriptive use of the pronoun they for the person resistant to he or she. I favour HD's revision, when is a woman not a woman? When obviously she is sleet and hail and a stuffed seagull." I mean, aside, stuffed seagull. "But in French, sleet is masculine, seagull feminine, so where to draw the line? There are but 26 letters in the Roman alphabet and life is short. Gertrude Stein said of her large white poodle Basket that of his ABCs he knew only the B's, basket, bread and ball. With canine simplicity of my LGBs, I use only the L's, lesbian and love. This is not to disrespect all efforts of inclusiveness and search for identity and self-expression. I want a place in the rainbow. But I am a tyro in this language class, and when writing of past times, today's language seems incongruous. I cannot talk about cisgender for Virginia Woolf, call Breyer they, or struggle with no modernism without quilt bag. And all the initials in the alphabet will not help in what I hope shines through, the uniqueness, the utter singularity of each individual life." And I sort of get what she's getting at in that, yes, of course, there is a language and vernacular today that was not so much or not at all in existence really in the time, you know, 100 years ago when this is being written about. So yes, I understand not wanting to retrospectively apply terms and phraseology to people that we don't know how they would have identified. I mean, Breyer obviously purposely chose her own name and chose a gender neutral name quite obviously, but this was, you know, and maybe today she would have regarded herself as non-binary, but we don't know because she isn't alive today, and therefore I think it's reasonable to refer to her in a way that she referred to herself. But at the same time, I don't know that that needs explaining. I think it felt a little bit does protest too much and comes back to the kind of, well, you're saying about not being prescriptive, but at the same time you're like, they were all lesbians and it was lesbians and modernism and blah, blah, blah. And so we come back to what I was saying earlier about the kind of the slightly arbitrary nature of the grouping. And I can't quite square it all in my head. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because, I mean, she mentions just before, doesn't she, that Natalie Barney nailed her colour. Natalie Barney, sorry, nailed her colours. "I am lesbian. One need not hide of it, nor boast of it. Though being other than normal is a perilous advantage." But she's the only one, if I remember rightly, who did identify as a lesbian. I think the bit that riled me was the bit when it says, "And now there is prescriptive use of the pronoun there." Who's prescribing it? Sorry, yeah. But like, people choose to use it as their pronoun, that's absolutely fine. Nobody's prescribing it for anybody.
No, exactly.
So it's just, I suppose it's partly, I think I partly read it with that sort of head on of the climate that we're living in terms of how people identify and all the rest of it. Like, particularly in the UK, we've just got such a toxic environment around it, I think, that it's hard not to read something and immediately like go, so what are you actually getting at? What's your position? What are you doing? And which is as bad as, I think, you know, the other side of it. So
yeah, for sure.
It was an odd. It's like you do if you're writing something academic, you have to state your position. But I think it was the tone of it, or at least how I read the tone of it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think I read it the same way, and it's slightly kind of, it bristled me a little bit, and that is probably, you know, that might well be on me, you know. But
like the title, it's provocative.
Yeah. I was provoked.
Yes, me too.
I was provoked. I was not provoked, however, by square haunting. Look at that segue.
Whoa, smooth.
I'm a pro. Square haunting, 5 women, freedom in London between the wars, by Francesca Wade. Published by Faber in 2020. Now, this is another group biography. As I said, it takes as its sort of central hook is the fact that all of these women at some point lived in Mecklenburg Square in Bloomsbury, which is really close to where I work. It's so I think maybe part of what I liked about it is simply kind of, oh yeah, I know that street. That sort of recognition. And the 5 women that Wade looks at are HD, who was partner of Briar, Dorothy L. Sayers, who best known for the Lord Peter Wimsey novels, Jane Harrison, who was a classicist, Eileen Power, who was an economic historian, and the most famous member that she talks about is Virginia Woolf. I really, really, really liked this book. With the caveat that I feel like Virginia Woolf has been written about enough, and sort of that was the chapter that I found least interesting, just because there wasn't particularly anything that I didn't know. I feel like I know enough. But I love, and I say that as a Woolf fan, you know, I love her novels, but I don't need to read that much more about her. But my favourite actually chapters were Eileen Power, who I'd never heard of, economic history not being my specialist subject, and Dorothy L. Sayers, who obviously I know, but I've never actually read any of the Lord Peter Wimsey novels. They were all women who were kind of going against the grain of society in one way or another. But what I liked about this book, apart from the writing, which is just excellent, is the fact that it wasn't all writers and artists. I love the fact that there was a classicist in there. I love the fact there was an economic historian in there, because even though economic history, as I say, is not an area I really know, anything about, if I'm honest, that is not to say that there are not interesting figures within those areas. And I found Eileen Power completely fascinating.
So in a shock horror moment, my 2 favourite chapters were exactly the same as yours. This has not happened in a long time. No. Eileen Power was my favourite out of the 5 of them. I thought she was brilliant. So right from the bit, so I was talking about clothes before. So one of the things, so she gets the bloody first, which she's not allowed to be awarded at the time, but she gets the first. And then she becomes an academic. And I love this. So she turns up to give a lecture. The historian and diplomat Charles Webster remembered an audible gasp of surprise when Power, radiant in a glamorous evening gown, arrived late to a dinner in her honour at Harvard, and the table of hoary scholars realised that this enchanting creature was the learned lady who they had come to meet. A.G. Colton recalled first meeting Power when she accosted him in the street and asked for advice on sources for the lives of medieval women. He openly admitted that noticing her stylish clothes and easy charm, he took it for granted that this was one more fashionable girl with a momentary enthusiasm for research. It was 2 years later when he read a 700-page study of medieval nunneries and found it incomparably better in quality than anything of the kind that has been done on this subject before or since in any European language, that he realised the error of his initial assumption. Power saw no reason why an interest in clothes and a sense of humour could not be combined with professional rigour. But it's sobering to wonder how many more fashionable girls may have abandoned their enthusiasms on recognising that pursuing an academic career would require them to justify themselves at every juncture.
Juncture.
Don't know how you say that word. But yeah, and I thought that was really interesting. That's the conversation. So it made me think of Zadie Smith and how she dresses, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, like the number of pieces you read about those women because they dress nicely. Or fashionably or whatever, and yeah, same bullshit, different century.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And one, I mean, that in a way that goes back to the bit you quoted from No Modernism Without Lesbians about the kind of daring to wear plus fours, and frankly I bring back the plus four. I would wear plus fours.
I have got some trousers that my boyfriend refers to as my pantaloons. They are fucking comfy, Kirsty, and they are also rainbow coloured, so
beautiful. Yeah. I love it. We are having exactly that thing, and there is that whole thing of and I do get it, you know. Recently there was that Vogue shoot with Zadie Smith. There was an interview with her and then kind of loads of incredible photos of her in Vogue. And that is not to say that you can't be interested in fashion, but these are, you know, fiercely intelligent women, and it shouldn't be most memorable that they've just done a Vogue shoot.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what I loved about Eileen Power as well was sort of how unapologetically intellectual she was, you know, throughout, but yet would also still have like kitchen discos.
Yeah, she sounded really cool. I wanted to be her friend.
Me too. She's our one for the girl squad this year.
Yes, I think so. I also very much enjoyed, the one thing I will talk about in a minute, the one thing that I learned in the Virginia Woolf chapter that I didn't know, because like you, I'm fed up hearing about Virginia Woolf. Mm. And she wrote one of my favourite novels, but still, I don't care. So when Eileen Powers, one of the books she published was called Medieval People, which is one that was brought back into print later on by one of her friends. But it was populated with prioresses, pilgrims, cloth workers and wool traders. If it was original in its focus on ordinary people whose lives were, if less spectacular, certainly not less interesting than those of the aristocrats, criminals or otherwise exceptional figures, predominantly men whose voices have survived in the records. And I loved that she concentrated on, you know, quote, normal people. So in that, there is something else I want to say about Eileen Power before we move on from her, but I'm just going to point out that the one thing that I learned about in the Virginia Woolf chapter was this, because obviously Virginia Woolf was not that interested in normal people. No. So what year was this? 1940. So Cyril Connolly had attacked Wolfe, Joyce and Proust as ivory tower dwellers, claiming that recent Marxist criticism of their work had set fire to a lot of rotten timber. Throughout this year, she exchanged letters with a Huddersfield mill worker, way go on Yorkshire, named Agnes Smith, who had read Three Guineas and wrote to complain that Wolfe seemed to consider working women and the daughters of educated men as a race apart. Wolfe's replies haven't survived, but she evidently responded to Smith's criticism seriously, and the pair corresponded for some time on friendly terms. When Smith pointed out that she might herself have written Three Guineas, had she received access to books, stimulating conversation and economic freedom, Wolfe urged Smith to publish her autobiography with the Hogarth Press. Now, I think Wolfe missed the point a little bit there. However, I do like the fact that she got challenged by a mill worker and maybe Gabby Young. Is it Gabby Young from the Booker?
Gabby Wood.
I always mix them up. So maybe Gabby Wood needs to take a leaf out of Virginia Woolf's book. Who knows? Anyway. I can't resist the opportunity to get that in. I'm sorry. Never have said what she said. Anyway.
Indeed, indeed. Can we talk about Jane Harrison?
We can. I'm going to come. Do you want me to come back to Eileen Power, or should I just do my last bit, which is?
Oh no, go for it. Sorry. Yeah.
So she eventually gets married. So it takes her a really long time to get married because she's quite happy living in a, like, she shares with her friends, but her friends, she says something about she's away during the week and the friends are away during the week and she's out most of the weekend. So she essentially feels like she lives on her own and she's having a great time. But she marries a guy that she's been friends with for a really long time. And they seem to have like quite a nice marriage. But she says she gets annoyed at all these congratulations cards that come from her friends after they've had like a fairly quiet ceremony and whatever. She lamented the widespread assumption that the ideal wife should endeavour to model herself upon a judicious mix of a cow, a muffler, a shadow, a mirror, a lump of plasticine, a doormat and a vacuum, and algebraically indicated by a negative. And then it said, should her friend Marjorie follow the example of several peers who had lost their old interests and their old individuality and their old friendships upon their marriages? Power insisted with mock seriousness that she would never speak to her again. The abstract cause which I care for more than anything else is the cause of women. And it seems to me that until women learn to keep their individuality after marriage and to recognise that love is not the only thing in the world and its satisfaction with all that entails, their only function, we shall never get anywhere or be anything. Mm. And again, I felt a bit like we're still having that argument, but like I loved the way what she thought the ideal wife was supposed to look like. I thought it was great. So yes, my new friend. I know she's dead, but she's my new friend.
That means that she can't tell you that she's not her friend.
True.
I'm all for it. Jane Harrison, I found completely fascinating. I'm not sure I liked her, but I found her completely fascinating. And I think my favourite thing about her story, so she was a classicist at Cambridge before moving to London. Later on, and living in Mecklenburg Square, she was sort of known at one point. She was called the cleverest woman in England, which was probably meant in a more patronising way. But towards the end of her life, she sort of had she developed this sort of companionship relationship with Hope Merleys, who was a student and many years, sort of 30 years her junior, there or thereabouts, and they ended up living together for the rest of Harrison's days. And when Harrison was in her mid-70s, I think she was like 75 or 76 or whatever, they staged a rebirth and burnt all of her, like loads of her papers and letters and stuff like that, like decades worth of work, just absolutely burnt it. And then they started a kind of community of Russian emigres, and Jane Harrison ended up writing a book of fairy tales about bears.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the whole bear thing, which was a bit odd.
It's so, a lot of bears.
Yeah, I had a complete issue about the relationship with Hope Merleys, obviously, because I'm a former teacher and it's just wrong and can't even, regardless of like what gender anybody is. But yeah, it got this whole thing about how they communicated via a bear called Old Something, wasn't it? I know its initials were OO, but I can't remember what the other O stood for. But yeah, so they used it as a tool to communicate with each other, and then she wrote a book about it. Or she wrote a book from the point of view of the bear or something. I was just like, you are mad.
There was a lot of bear action.
Well, maybe it was Kirsty, but but that doesn't survive in the records.
No, you're absolutely right. That said, I've remembered her.
Yes, I thought it was interesting how much so, not just her, but Power as well. She got rid of lots of her stuff as well, didn't she? So there's quite a few times that Francesca Wade says that there's not that much information outside of what's already publicly known about her, although to be fair, as we both said, we'd never heard of her before. So
yeah, maybe we would have done if we were classicists or
economic historians. And entirely the opposite way, there's way too much information about Virginia Woolf.
We're talking about her a lot for someone that we don't want to don't want to talk
she's
about
all
that.
over the book, isn't she? I mean, she crops up repeatedly because she's, I mean, I would imagine, obviously I don't know, but I would imagine this book probably sold on the back of the fact that there's Virginia Woolf in it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to get someone to pick up a book, then I guess there has, you know, I can understand why you'd want someone that most people have heard of in the book as a way into it, although it is, she is the kind of last person that she writes about. And I, you know, I get that absolutely, totally. But I think there is something about reading about people that you might never have heard of, that I really like. And I know that there are kind of, it'd be really easy to kind of cast this, and No Modern Is Without Lesbians to an extent, as, you know, another book of women daring to have an opinion. But I do think that these are good specimens of the genre, as it were.
Well, we've got plenty of books about men with opinions, haven't we? You know.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. But like using that as the main selling point, as here are women who have opinions. But yes, but
we all have an opinion.
We have all have an opinion. Are any of those
do a podcast opinions? About our opinions?
A group biography of us, that's what they're gonna be. Later of the future.
Yeah, all associated via Zoom. Yes. I have got to point out as well, I know I'm coming back to clothes again, because like I found it one of the most interesting bits of the book. Like, there were people's opinions on marriage and on how to live and the clothes. Dorothy L. Sayers, I love this bit. So later in life, Sayers would ride a motorbike and dress in masculine attire. You go, love. Quote, if the trousers do not attract you, she insisted in an essay, so much the worse. For the moment, I do not want to attract you. I want to enjoy myself as a human being.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's very good. I've still never been able to read Alice B. Toklas, though.
I've never even attempted to read it or any Gertrude Stein at all. And the bits that were quoted in the book, I went, I do not want to read pages of this.
I do find a lot of modernism sort of needlessly opaque, but I'm a little Victorian soul at heart, so give me a narrative arc. I want a narrative arc and a bit of plot.
Even as somebody who writes and loves experimental fiction, the quotes like from Tender Buttons, I was just like, nah. Who's got, it's like Finnegan's Wake, never gonna read it. Who's got time for that?
Well, indeed. I remember a lecturer at university, and this was a lecturer who was lecturing on Ulysses, saying to the assembled lecture theatre that when he was at university, he and a few friends, in a kind of very pretentious English literature student way, decided that they were going to read Finnegan's Wake, and they were going to meet weekly in the pub to discuss their reading of Finnegan's Wake. And within a year, they'd only got to page 50. And he'd still never finished it. And I was like, do you know what? And you're an English literature lecturer. I don't need to read Finnegan's Wake. Mm. I think my life is fine without it.
Well, going back to something I commented on earlier, I had an A-level English teacher who confessed to never having read Middlemarch because life was too short. I read it. I can't say I disagree with him. I know that's a popular opinion. I'm sorry, but there we are.
I am someone who has an actual master's in Victorian studies and has never finished Vanity Fair.
Now, I have finished Vanity Fair, but I can't remember much about it.
I got to page 300, so it wasn't like I started it and only read 10 pages. I got as far as page 300, then put it down and just never picked it up again.
All fine.
Controversially, though, for speaking to you, I do think Bleak House is one of the best books ever written.
Yes, well, the less said about Dickens. Having said that, I am currently reading Demon Copperhead and it is very, very good, I have to say. So, you know.
I am not
bothered about the original, but Barbara Kingsolver, I'm there with you. Love it, it's all good.
Next, she has to do Bleak House.
No.
Yeah. So, those were the group biographies. And next week, we are doing something completely different. We're going sci-fi.
It's sci-fi week because you claim you've never read sci-fi, which is nonsense.
No, it's not that I've claimed I've never read sci-fi.
Okay.
It's that I am not a sci-fi. I'm not habitually a sci-fi reader. I've got a problem with spaceships,
So both of next week's books are set on spaceships.
and I've already read one of them and I loved it. So I'm having to eat my spaceship words.
Which one did you love? Or which one have
The
you read?
employees.
Right, okay.
So yes, The Employees by Olga Raven, which is translated from Danish by Martin Aitken, is one of the books. And the other book we're reading is Far From the Light of Heaven by Tade Thompson, which I've not read yet. And maybe I will love it as well. But I've got absolutely no good reason to be spaceship averse. It is conscious bias of spaceships. And I yeah, it's my problem, and I'm just having to learn to get over
Yes. Well, I'd sort of foisted this on you, but it'll all be good.
well, it at least 50% good so far.
Onto a winner. I'm taking that as a win. Yes, so more on that next week because I've not read either of them yet. Yes. What else do I need to say? In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And other than social media, we're both on Instagram. Kirsty's at other Kirsty. And I am at Naomi Frisby, so you can find us there as well. Otherwise, we will see you back here next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.